McLean. Dick Coach's Corner.
You're listening to the Rugby Coach's Corner podcast with your host, Andy Plymer.
For someone to explain.
Bringing you up-to-date coaching concepts from the world of rugby. Sharing ideas to make the game better.
Welcome to episode number 49 of the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. I'm your host, Andy Plymer, and joining me today is Dr. Nick Winkelman. Dr. Winkelman has been the head of athletic performance and science at the IRFU since April 2016. Before that, he held various roles at Exos in the United States. Initially, he completed his bachelor's in exercise and sports science at Oregon State, and then undertook a master's in strength and conditioning at Edith Cowan University, and then a doctorate at Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions. He is certified through the NSCA, the USA Weightlifting Association, and the USA Track and Field Association, and is an internationally recognized speaker and author on topics pertaining to skill acquisition, coaching science, movement skill development, and athletic profiling. And it's a pleasure to have him on the show. So welcome, Dr. Winkelman.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much. We can stick with coach. Doctor's just for my mom to brag.
Cool. Well, quite a journey so far. What got you interested initially into pursuing your degree and then your master's and following up with a PhD after that?
You know, I think everybody has probably experiences when they're young or when they're in high school that inevitably have a knock-on effect into their later career. And, you know, for me, it was simple as, you know, playing sports. I played American football and basketball and all sorts of things. So I loved training for that. But also, my grandfather had a gym membership, and he was just a stickler of going to the gym. And inevitably, at 15, he got me my first job there, just working in the weight room, cleaning it up, helping people out here and there. And, you know, fast forward now, well over 15 years later, I'm still doing it. I just fell in love with the training process. And I came to realize quite quickly that, you know, those that can't teach, as they say, and I definitely had an affinity for teaching. And what I just loved to teach was movement and thus strength and conditioning. So that really was the catalyst for exercise science at Oregon State. And then inevitably through the master's and onto the PhD.
Yeah, so the master's at Edith Cowan, former guest David Joyce, was he involved with that as a lecturer?
It's funny you should ask because, yeah, I think he was just starting to lecture. He did not lecture on my course because at the time he was attending. And funny enough, first time that I met Joycey was when we went to the 2-week kind of intensive learning that they do on the back end of that curriculum. And that's where we met Andrew Gray and a number of other great guys, Nicholas Superina, all obviously in rugby at some point in their career and just been fantastic friends ever since.
Ah, great. Okay. So before the IRFU position, you were Exos in the United States for quite a long time. What were some of the key learnings and takeaways from that role? And I believe you were mostly involved with the NFL athletes, is that correct?
Yeah, so funny enough, the mentor I met at Oregon State University, he had known Mark Verstegen. He's really the one that pointed me in that direction. And when I got hired in 2006 at the end of an internship, yeah, my career there really took on two specific veins. One was inevitably running all of the coach education courses for Exos, which are better known by the name mentorship. So when I started, we were, you know, running a couple 5-day courses in Phoenix, Arizona. And when I left, I'm proud to say we were running courses in 22 different countries, as well as launched all of our online education and the Exos Performance Specialist Cert. So we did a lot there trying to take what we felt were best practices, applied best practices, and share it with the world of coaches. And then obviously if half my time was coaching coaches, the other half was having a platform to get better at that, which obviously was coaching athletes. So while I was there, I got to work with a lot of different sports, from baseball to ice hockey, basketball, American football, touch of rugby, and everything in between. But correctly, as you stated, most of what I did was in the NFL vein, and in particular working with college players prepping to go into the NFL through the NFL Combine. So that provided quite a unique outlet to basically have a definitive start at the beginning of January, definitive end at the end of February, and roughly 6 to 8 weeks in between, where you take an already physically supreme athlete and try to improve that supremacy as they go into the NFL Combine and on their way to optimize their draft status. So it created a lot of learning out of necessity on how to become a better coach.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, even though they're finely tuned athletes and the like, they must have also brought their own problems in terms of, you know, mobility, flexibility, stability, and those kind of things that you had to treat on a individual case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And interestingly enough, you know, you talk about individualization. That really was the whole idea behind athletes' performance. Now, Exos, when Mark Verstegen started it back in the late 90s, in that he saw that there were all these pro athletes that had these unique individual high-performance needs. However, they weren't being served in their off-season because a lot of these players, unlike other countries, you know, they don't stay with their team in their off-season. They go back to wherever they're from or wherever it's going to be sunny, and they still want to get their training in. So inevitably, he saw that from a business opportunity and almost an ethical responsibility to these players to build these interdisciplinary teams that covered everything across physio and nutrition and mindset, as well as strength and conditioning, and bringing it all under one roof, which to your point, allowed us to provide a very focused service through a consistent system that allowed each of these individual players to achieve their goals, but in a slightly different way because of their unique needs.
All right. Well, you're over a year into your IRFU position. What have been some of the highlights so far in that role? And then what are also some of the areas that you want to work on and focus on as we move deeper into this World Cup cycle?
How much time do you have?
About 45 minutes.
Yeah, Andrew, because that's the tough one. Well, I can tell you this. Coming to work here has been an absolute joy. You know, when the opportunity presented itself, I knew it was going to be scary coming to a new country with my family, to a new sport, right, to start again. And for me, that was the exact challenge I was looking forward to, and it has not disappointed. So probably the greatest level of joy I've gotten is getting to know all of our players, getting to know all of our coaches, since my position sits across all the national teams and the four provincial teams. There are just so many great individuals I get to interact with day in, day out. So that's probably been the greatest source of joy. And within that, obviously, source of challenge is ensuring that you're developing meaningful relationships that allow you to work with all the coaches and players at the level that they require to improve. And obviously then within that, once you get to know everybody and you've listened and you've done kind of this organic needs analysis, then it really is looking about what are we the best at and how do we strengthen those strengths? Where do we all collectively feel our opportunities for improvement might be? And those might fall into sports science. They might fall into training methods. They might fall into communication, right? All these various areas that make up the high performance culture of sport. And we simply prioritize those and we attack them step by step in kind of a systematic, democratic way, whereby we bring in all the right individuals, we weigh in, we build something, we have people reflect on it, and then we execute. And the fact of the matter is we've done that over the last year and a half on a number of projects across S&C, across sports science. And I think we all feel that we're moving in a very strong direction. But it still, at the end of the day, comes down to the people, because I'm only one person, and I really see myself as a facilitator, as a guide, to help take all these great minds and great ideas and move them in the right direction that we all vote and say is important.
Yeah, that's great. So now with Pro 14 kicking off, are you more working with the individual provinces as opposed to working with the individual athletes when, say, an Irish camp would be called and you'd be hands-on in that regard?
Yeah, you know, Andrew, so maybe I can just give a little bit of a deeper look into my role. Technically, what's cool about what I get to do is obviously each of our four teams, and for those that are not familiar with Irish rugby. We're a centralized rugby union, which means all four pro teams wrap up under the Irish Rugby Football Union banner. Mm-hmm. So that means we have head of athletic performance, head strength conditioning coaches over all of our national teams. And then obviously we have heads of athletic performance over those four provincial teams, as well as heads of the academy. And my job fundamentally is to work with all of those strength and conditioning coaches and then ensure obviously alignment with our nutrition and physiomedical and rugby counterparts. In doing that, you know, I very much so, each day is slightly different. But if I was to give everyone a snapshot of what a month looks like, I spend at least one day in every province. So that's going to be four detailed days. And when we're down there, we're catching up. We're talking about coaching. We're talking about professional development. I might get stuck in and do a bit of coaching with a select group of players if that's what's required on the day. It's really just being that resource and that sounding board for whatever those high performance teams need. And obviously those consistent visits are critical for my relationship with the players as well as the coaches. And then very similarly, when we are in a national team camp, whether it might be the Autumn Series or Six Nations, you know, I'll get to spend time shoulder to shoulder with Jason Cowman and our actual national team, seeing those same boys that I see out in the province, but obviously now as a collective wearing the green jersey. And again, working with Jason to provide whatever support best fits within camp. So very much so it's diverse. But then at the same time, each week I get to cut my teeth coaching, as I love to do, working with our sevens girls, doing two speed sessions a week right now, get ready to go for the series again. So it's quite diverse, which I think is important just to be in touch with this great sport and great country you're working in.
Man, that just sounds amazing. And you're obviously getting a huge amount of pleasure out of the role. Moving on to the topic of the podcast, a lot of your work before you took on the IRFU position was in the area of attentional focus, especially in terms of speed development. For those who aren't aware of what attentional focus is, what is it in theory, and what's some of the research out there that backs it up as a sound coaching technique for those who want to consider applying it?
Really, really good question. It's funny you should ask, because I had to ask that same question for about 5 years before I realized what I was looking for was called attentional focus. I think a little backstory probably helps. You know, when I was first cutting my teeth as a strength coach, I noticed something unique about coaches that I saw as being kind of elite, or the ones that I was looking up to, and the ones that were kind of like me, just getting started. And what I noticed wasn't so much what they were doing in terms of the X's and O's, the reps and the sets. Rather, I noticed how they were doing it, you know, how they opened a session, how they closed a session, how they communicated, how they taught. And one of my mentors in particular, you know, we used to call him the cueing ninja. You know, he could get people to feel a specific muscle. Let's say if he was working with a bodybuilder, or execute a movement with a given fluidity or rhythm that, you know, prior to that point, this individual was unable to achieve. And it was like his words were a magic wand. And I just was enamored by his ability. So very early days, I became fascinated with this kind of invisible thing that we call communication and how it impacted the learning process. So it took a couple of years before I revisited it again, but probably back in 07, 08, it started to bother me again, and I wanted to look into it deeply. So I started looking up things like cueing and instruction. And at the time, there was plenty of research on instruction and feedback, but it wasn't quite what I was looking for. And inevitably, I came to find that in the motor learning research, what we might call cues as strength coaches or personal trainers, they called attentional focus. It makes sense because when you give a cue, you're asking someone to focus their attention, think about something in particular that you feel somehow is going to help them move better. So that is what attentional focus is. We're focusing this mental spotlight on what we feel is correct for the next rep. Now, as you get into this literature, it basically dichotomizes language. It breaks it into two buckets, right? And that is where you can either draw someone's attention towards their body and what we could call the movement process. So squeeze your glute, squeeze your quad, dorsiflex your ankle, extend your hip, so on and so forth. or we could draw their attention towards the movement outcome, such as push the ground away, drive the bar towards the ceiling, flick the ball towards the attacker, right, your opponent, or obviously in this case the person sits to your left or to your right, whatever it might be. But in that case, we're talking about the outcome that we're trying to achieve. And initially, when you ask coaches, which do you think is better, internal cues, external cues, or do you think maybe it depends, right? Certain times internal is better, certain times external is better. And most people say it depends. They think there's probably certain times we're giving internal cues, talking about the body and the movement process, especially if you want to correct a movement error, that might be the best way to go. And then in other times, an external cue might be the best way to go, especially if you're trying to get performance, such as speed or jump height. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, when you look at the research, there's probably north of 275 to 300 quality papers on the topic. They've looked at everything from balance to sprinting to change of direction to weightlifting to golf, tennis, volleyball, you name it. I don't think they've explicitly looked at rugby, but they've definitely looked at field sports. And across all of those papers, you're looking at well over 90 to 95% of them consistently show that external cues typically allow for better performance when you're initially learning the skill, but more importantly, by providing an external cue on the outcome you're trying to achieve, that actually allows for better learning. So what they do is they do these studies, let's say on kicking a ball for accuracy. And one group is told to focus on, let's say their leg. Another group is told to focus on the ball. And another group is told to not give it any focus cues at all, just learn through doing. And what they typically find in a study like that is that an external cue may give you a slight advantage during practice, or maybe it doesn't. But definitely, it's not worse than giving an internal cue, let's say. But here's the interesting thing. When they bring these people back, 24, 48 hours a week later, and they have them do this kicking again, and they're looking at accuracy, what they'll tend to find is those that were coached utilizing an external cue whereby they focused on the ball, the trajectory, or the outcome where the ball should finish, that inevitably leads to better learning than any other form of communication. And they have shown this over and over again in so many different contexts. So while I tend to not be someone who is black and white and absolute, it is fair to say that when you are coaching a dynamic multi-joint movement, whether they are a novice or an expert, if you're trying to put ideas in their head right before they go and perform that movement, you're better off ensuring that that is in some form or fashion an external cue than something internally that relates to their body. And we can unpack that a little bit deeper, but at least that gives the high level theory and what the science and practice, in my opinion, suggests.
Yeah, I think as coaches, especially early in our coaching career, we're very keen to pass on our knowledge, and it's very easy, I think, to fall into that trap of giving athletes 4, 5, 6 points to focus on that are all internal. So what you're saying is that realistically, we should be focusing on, say for something like catch pass, we should be focusing on what the ball looks like in the air as it leaves your hands, for example. Is that where you're working towards?
Well, and let me be clear on this, because I've now presented this topic, fortunately, to a number of rugby coaches. There's a couple questions that always come up. Number one, they'll say, are you saying we can never reference the body? And let me be clear, that's not what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Let's say we're teaching, the catch or the pass. General instructions would suggest that you might talk about body position, hand placement on the ball, right? How the body should move in space. These are what we might call descriptions of how the movement is performed. Basically what we can think of as the what, okay? That's fine to do. But right before they go to perform this movement, when you want to give them a lasting thought to actually focus on while they are physically throwing, that is where we would want it to be externally focused. Thinking about going pocket to pocket, throw it on a straight line, rocket, bullet, whatever the word, whatever the language might be. And frankly, a rugby coach would have better context to know what to call it using externally focused language. That's the key. And the other thing that I teach within this coursework on language is the power of using an analogy. You know, I want you to throw the ball as if it was, you know, a plane going from one pocket to the next. As if we had a laser from your pocket to your teammate's pocket, I want you to throw it along that laser, you know, or the ball is a flashlight. I want you to flash that light at their back pocket, whatever it might be. These are all analogies that start to portray, at least in those examples, that you want a straight pass, right? So analogy and metaphor, more often than not, can give them a very easy insight to understand what you want them to do by relating it to something that they already know, that they've already experienced. Like, oh, that's what you want me to do. No problem at all. But if we say we need your elbow flex, your shoulder here, your feet here, all of those rules inevitably overflow their attention. It is fundamentally paralysis by analysis. External cue simplifies all of that into a single intentional focus point that basically gives them what needs to happen and allows the body to figure it out.
Yeah, and I think going back to that new coach, I think a lot of people, when they start out coaching, they fall into that trap of they want to see perfect practice. They want to see perfect mechanics. And, you know, that can be troublesome, I feel like, especially if you're working with, say, a tight five player who hasn't had a lot of experience in passing the ball. Does it really matter if the mechanics look good, or is it more about getting from point A to point B accurately and quickly if that's what's required?
So let's unpack this, Andrew. So let me ask you, if you think about the pass, talk to me about, from a technique perspective, what are the non-negotiables from the start to an end of a pass? And let's say it's not a quick one. You're trying to pass over 10 meters to be true, in your opinion, for that to be successful.
There could be, you could talk about 20, but I think if you focus really on the follow through, that can be
okay. I'm gonna stop you there.
Yeah.
I'm gonna stop you there, because if you ask a pitching coach in baseball, mm-hmm. or a batting coach in baseball, yeah. or let's say a hitting coach in ice hockey or field hockey for that mm-hmm. matter, almost always they talk about this end point, right? Mm-hmm. The finish. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that, and you can kind of see where I'm going with this, that end point oftentimes is highly related to the outcome you're trying to achieve, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. The loft of the pass, the speed of the pass, the direction, whether I'm hitting something or throwing it in the case of rugby. What's interesting, though, is the movement that leads to that follow through. We've got the elbow, we've got the trunk, we've got the shoulder, we've got all these different joints involved. And typically, those are the ones that we're coaching when we give these internal cues. But what you just said there to me is really, it's the follow through. It's that finished position probably inevitably dictates the quality of the pass. And interestingly enough, we know that from a skill learning perspective, that oftentimes is the truth. That the finish of a movement, that needs to have low variability. They need to be able to repeat and recycle that over and over again. But those that are the best at what they do, they might have high variability in their joints, in the physical movement that leads to that outcome. Because let's say they're in a low position when they're making the pass. They're on the run. They're static, right? They have to be able to make that pass from a lot of different positions in different scenarios, still hitting that optimal end position if they want to be successful. But how they get to that end position, that tends to be and needs to be, if you're a pro, variable. And thus, without going too deep, an external focus actually allows and encourages the right finish to be successful. It allows those degrees of freedom, those joints involved to get there, to kind of adapt based on the scenario. Counter to that is giving an internal cue, which basically says, forget about the end point, forget about even the outcome of the task. Just think about this one joint. And even though that's not what the coach intends when they give it, that's in fact what happens when the athlete focuses on it.
Okay, great. And what about decision making? Is there room, in your opinion, for using an external focus when coaching decision making? Decision making in rugby and coaching seems to be a bit of a holy grail in terms of the best coaches tend to be the best at coaching decision making. What do you feel about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I was just up in Ulster the other day and we had this exact conversation. So I'll try to give a synopsis of it. So when we look at decision making, what are we really talking about? We're talking about a player that identifies the right cues in the environment. And times it's cues that are coming from their opponent, whether I'm on defense or attack. And whoever can pick up on those earliest cues, let's say I'm on attack, I can see that I've sat down my defender. The sooner I can pick that up, the sooner I can attack that space, hopefully make a line break that ends up in a try. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to condition our players to be able to see the right things, take that information on board, and then use it to make effective decisions. Well, what does that come back to? While that involves a lot of variables, still the number one thing that you're manipulating is how they deploy their attention and thus what they focus on. We know with a lot of decision-making research, the difference between, let's say, a novice and an expert goalkeeper during a penalty shot in football is oftentimes, soccer, is oftentimes the difference in focusing on. The expert will go body ball, body ball. That's all they look at. Whereas the novice, if we look at their vision, it's like a shotgun, right? Their eyes are all over the shop and they're not focusing on the factors that really matter. And experts tend to know what those factors are implicitly. You could ask them, what are they? They might not even be able to tell you, but if they go and play, they're amazing decision makers because implicitly they know how to get the early sign, the early cue, and attack the space in the example that we gave earlier. So how does an external focus play into that? Well, in its simplest form, let's say I'm doing a reactive agility training day and I have a 1v1 drill. We do a lot of these, okay? And now I'm giving this person a lot of internal cues. What I fundamentally have done is say, hey, I want you to stop focusing on all the sensory information around you, in this case, your visual sensory information, and I want you to deploy more of your conscious attention to the body and how your body is moving in space. Inevitably, if they're pure to that focus, they're not going to have as much room to focus on other factors, such as the body movement of the opponent in front of them, which is why an internal cue not only would be detrimental to the quality of their technique, but also, in my opinion, detrimental to their decision-making timeline. They're just simply not going to make the decision as fast, and thus they come across as slow, both mechanically and in the decision that followed. Conversely, if I give you an external focus cue before you go into that 1v1 scenario, and all I say is this, okay, when you go to make your step, whenever it is in this process, and I'm talking to the attacker here, whenever you go to make that step, I want you to push that ground away like it's on fire, right? Or I want you to push the ground away like you're trying to split the earth. And all I'm trying to do in that case is give an external cue that emphasizes the intensity with which that step takes place. So what I'm now doing is I've drawn their attention more to the environment, and I've also reinforced that only once that step is started, that's where that cue needs to be deployed. I haven't talked about their head, shoulders, knees, and toes. I haven't given them any information to focus and reflect on the body, which means they can still focus on the defender in front of them. And thus, the external cue not only should not disrupt, but if anything, should reinforce the environment that we want this person to focus in on. Okay. And again, I think it would also depend where their errors are. Another external cue might be not even talking about the step. It might be where their vision is. Hey, I want you to focus on their belt buckle. I want you to focus on staring right through them. That's still an external focus. If we felt more the issue was in where they were looking or the decision itself, but it all falls into that bucket. Now, let me just add one thing to that, Andrew, that I think everyone will find interesting. When we talk about decision-making in sport, we inevitably talk about decisions going wrong under high-pressure scenarios. And what do we typically call that? Well, if it's a big enough issue, we call that choking, okay? And in the choking literature, we know that there are two dominant theories. Theory number one is external distraction, and theory number two, which probably has more evidence, is internal distraction. And I'll talk about the second one. And basically what that states is when someone feels that they are under the high pressure to perform and they are being judged, thus if that performance does not go well, there potentially could be the consequences of people looking down on them, right, not being happy with the outcome, obviously in pro sports, the fans. And what that inevitably does is it causes this player to want to reduce the likelihood of failure. And what they tend to do then is they try to control their movement. And the idea is if they can control their movement, somehow they'll reduce the likelihood of making the mistake. But the fact of the matter is, when you try to mentally control a movement that is already automatic, inevitably what you were hoping to avoid is the consequence you cause by focusing on the body itself, because your attention isn't on the right things, whether it was the defender coming at you or the pitcher throwing the ball, in the case if you're a batter in baseball. And inevitably, you micromanage your movement, you distract yourself from the key variables you should focus on, and thus performance suffers. By the nature of it, that is almost what you are facilitating, one could argue, and evidence suggests this, by giving someone an internal cue. So you can see how then the language ties to so many things beyond just the movement at hand. And that hopefully was an insightful, albeit a little bit long-winded, way to tell you, yes, external cues matter for decision-making.
No, for sure. That's awesome stuff, and I'm sure listeners are going to get a bunch out of it. One thing I did want to come back to was coaching speed. You've developed an instructional framework for coaching speed using effective cueing. Are you able to discuss that a little bit and maybe let listeners know where they can get a hold of that content?
Absolutely. So the article you're talking about is actually on my ResearchGate. So if people go to ResearchGate and simply look up Nick Winkelman, all those articles that you're referencing are right there, and they're open for the public to get a hold of. Within that, basically, it comes from this idea that my colleagues and I developed when I was at Exos, called the tech model, that whereby every movement, you have this technique or this technical model that you want to see, what does good look like? You have this error model, what are the patterns of movement that can disrupt that? And then you have the C, the correcting or the coaching of that. And really, this framework you're talking about reflects that, in that we talk about, for sprinting, we have four major errors that can present themselves when you're watching someone sprint. So error number one has to do with body posture. Error number two has to do with what we call front side mechanics, or basically when the leg's going forward in acceleration. Error number three is backside mechanics, or when the leg is going back during the push. And then error number four typically has to do with arm action, right? And this gets back to your old Vern Gambetta Powell model of posture, arm action, leg action. Same exact idea. So basically, in this model, you have your four errors. And then across the top, you have all of your possible cues, right? The verbal cues you could use to correct those errors. And what I've done is basically come up with what I refer to the anatomy of a cue, which breaks it down into how the cue can encourage a certain focus of distance, direction, and description. And what we mean by that is a cue could be close to the body, fall. I want you to push the ground away, sprint to your opponent, sprint toward the timing gates, now that's farther away. We could talk about then the direction. So if I'm doing a barbell lift, I could tell you to drive the bar towards the ceiling. Well, that's a toward cue. Or I could tell you to drive the bar away from the bench. That's an away cue. And then finally, we have the descriptor. And more or less, these models provide a lot of examples that kind of reinforce what I'm going through now. But the key is just to understand your movement, understand the anatomy of the language you can use to change it, and basically have a checks and balances list, whether you physically create one or just run this as a mental model in the back of your head, so that you're not just using the same stagnant cues, but you're using the best language for the moment and the movement you're teaching and the person that's in front of you.
Yeah, that's really cool and really useful. And you know, I've obviously looked at the articles myself, so I'll definitely dig up the links and I'll put them in the show notes there for listeners to have a look at. All right, then, last question before we wrap things up. You had a pretty busy summer attending and speaking at a number of conferences. You also just recently had Franz Bosch in at Leinster. What were some of the key kind of takeaways that you got from that for your own professional development? What are some things that you can pass on to listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, getting out and presenting, one of the best parts of it is being able to learn from others. So, you know, it seems across the board at the various conferences I'm presenting at, one of the major themes is kind of moving away from what we do to looking at how we do it. You see a lot of people talking about motor learning and feedback and building relationships and behavior change. So I think all of those are themes that are not only relevant for your general population, but also our players. at the end of the day, they have behaviors that they need to modify as well, whether it's sleep, nutrition, habits with technology at night, those kind of things. So always a lot of learning there, little nuggets we can take away. Franz Bosch, good friend of mine. I was fortunate enough to bring him out to Exos a couple of years ago and did a four-day intensive course with him. So very much so getting to see him again reaffirmed a lot of ideas, you know. But the big thing that I think Franz is doing really, really a good job of is helping people understand what we refer to as the constraint-led model. So he almost sits, not in opposition, but he kind of talks about the opposite of what I do. If I'm talking about talking, he's talking about not talking and how to build environments that allow an individual to learn simply through the experience itself. You know, so for example, one of the things he's most known for is if you're watching somebody run and their body is all bent forward and their legs are behind them and it almost looks like they're going to fall on their face, simply having them hold a dowel, getting rid of their arms, encourages them to stand up straight, lift their legs, and run with a better push off the ground, because when you get rid of someone's arms, they become much more aware of the fact that they could fall and hit their face. So this whole idea of introducing constraints into the environment, kind of like a jump rope, right? You're either doing it or you're not. Riding a bike, you're either doing it or you're not. Bringing those same kind of self-limiting exercises to any context, but definitely has relevance in a rugby context, to help a player start to execute one movement pattern over another simply through the design of the drill rather than having to use language itself. And this kind of falls into this whole realm of implicit learning or learning through doing, which we know is very protective against choking or breakdown in competition. So the information he's putting out there is fantastic, especially around linear speed.
Ah, that's great. All right, well, we always end the show with the same final four questions. When you were a kid growing up in the United States, who was one of your favorite athletes or rugby players going around? I'm not sure how much rugby you watched as a kid, but who was one of your favorite players or athletes?
Well, you know, I, as you might expect, since I was new to rugby as of about a year and a half, 2 years ago, obviously I'd always known about it. I'd only followed it so far, but I think in, you know, the years leading up to here, there were two names that definitely stuck out. You know, one would have been Richie McCaw, and the other would have been from the Irish side, Paul O'Connell. Both of them really stood out and resonated with me because of their leadership and how they led through action and just the way that they were composed, and not only in what they did, but again, how they did it. And they really represented what those respective cultures and sports were all about. So I learned about them well before coming to Ireland and have massive respect for what both of those men have done for the sports in their countries.
Ah, cool. Two great names for sure, and fans of both of them, no doubt. All right, and what about now that you've been involved with rugby a bit more and seen a bunch of players going around, who are some of your favorites?
You know, I saw the question. I knew it was coming, and I, as I'm sure you can appreciate, I can't really answer that with just one, because I've got so many players that are just fantastic here. And to be honest with you, I'd probably name just about every single one of them if I could. But if in just going through our provinces, again, guys I've got to spend some time with, whether it's our captain, Rory Best, or an up-and-comer in Jacob Stockdale, you got people that are not only fantastic at the sport, but also are bringing the right mindset to it. You know, in Connacht, and for no one who's ever watched a rugby match in Connacht, when it's pissing outside rain and they're in ankle-high mud getting after it, you see the likes of the John Muldoons and the Kieran Marmions, just fantastic individuals who are stewards of the game and stewards of such a strong culture. I mean, Leinster, obviously, being Dublin-based, there are so many players. But guys, I think, that are getting everyone excited about the game and growing the population, whether it's a Joey Carberry or a Tyke Furlong. And obviously, the guys that have been carrying the torches, the Kian Healy's and the Jamie Heaslips, are fantastic. And then Munster, again, just heart and soul of a culture and a province and a country, you know, the likes of your Connor Murray's and obviously Paul coming from there. There's just so many great players. I could keep going, but those are definitely some individuals I think that are going to be stewards of the future and have already done great things for Irish rugby.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm a fan of a bunch of those names, and I'm just a fan of Irish rugby in general. So yeah, I totally agree. And I try to watch as many Pro 14 games as I can to keep in touch. And what about high-profile coaches? Who are some coaches that have influenced you in your career so far?
Yeah, you know, again, if we look at just our strength coaches, I can't say enough good things about these guys. You know, obviously Jason Kalman's a guy I get to work with all the time with the national team, fantastic. But obviously our leader, you know, Joe Schmidt, and David Nusafora from a high performance unit leadership perspective. But you know, from a rugby perspective, Joe Schmidt has just been a pleasure to work with. You know, as a newcomer, he's welcomed me with open arms to explain the game, to help have two-way discussions around how we can get better as a sport. And he's just been a phenomenal person to work with. And I look forward, hopefully, to many more years of working with him.
Awesome. Yeah, and he's definitely one I'd love to have a chat with for sure. Okay, last question. Who's someone in the grassroots end of the game who's doing great work, in your opinion, and deserves a shout-out?
You know, again, we have fantastic grassroots coaches. And when we look at this, especially at our academy and our age grade level, you know, guys that I'm looking up to right now, if it's Leinster, it's Peter Smith and Trevor Hogan. If it's Connacht, it's Eric Elwood, it's Colm Tucker. Munster, it's Peter Malone, Mark Butler. And Ulster, it's Kieran Campbell and Michael Black. And again, there's too many names to list, but these are the individuals really stewarding the grassroots age grade side of it, getting these kids excited about playing and playing at a high level.
Yeah, it's so important. And, you know, as a rugby fan, I'm really excited about the trajectory of Irish rugby. I really think this World Cup cycle and the upcoming World Cup that's 2 years away is going to be a real line in the sand for Irish rugby. And, you know, just as a fan of the game, I'm pretty keen to see how it goes. Really want to thank you for giving up your time, for coming on the show. I've learned a bunch, and there's so much good stuff in there for listeners and myself included. So I really want to just say thanks very much, and look forward to hopefully chatting to you another time.
Absolutely, Andrew, and I always appreciate guys like yourself who take the time to do this and share great information. So keep doing good work.
Awesome. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review via iTunes and keep listening for the next episode. You can also follow us on Twitter at RugbyCoachSCNR or via the website at therugbycoachescorner.com. Until next time, keep sharing ideas to make the game better.